Hey, it's Andrew. Just quickly before we start this episode, I want to tell you about one of my favorite podcasts, the Secure Ventures podcast. The host, Kyle McNulty, interviews cybersecurity founders about what they are building. I enjoy it because Kyle focuses on their technology, what it solves, why they build it, where it fits in the market. Also, listeners can understand the why of these startups. In some ways, it's a great complement to my own podcast where I focus on the go-to-market side, not the technology side. He's had some great guests on recently, for example, the CEO of Reality Defender, when they talked about the ins and outs of deepfake detection. He's had the co-founder and CEO of Ghost Security, and also the co-founder of Radical, Chris Peterson, who was incidentally a founder of Logrhythm, where they talk about the role of AI in the SOC. This is not a paid promotion. I just simply enjoy what Kyle is doing with his interviews and get a lot out of them. Check it out. It's the Secure Ventures podcast. Now on with this episode. Only a third of the companies that raise a Series A go on to also raise a Series C. Now, a few are acquired, fewer still go IPO, but most, unfortunately, just simply don't make it. This week's guest has scaled up three companies to be unicorns and now advises companies how to make the transition from getting go-to-market fit to scaling successfully. We talk about scaling too early, where to invest when scaling, how to think about getting the right executives and salespeople on the bus, and a whole lot more with Roland Siebelink, the founder and CEO of the Midstage Institute. Don't go away. Welcome to the Cybersecurity Go-To-Market podcast, where we tackle the question, how can cybersecurity companies grow sales faster? I'm your host, Andrew Monahan. Our guest today is Roland Siebelink, founder and CEO at Midstage Institute. Roland, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. It's such an honor to be on your podcast finally.
Well, you know, I'm looking forward to our discussion, Roland. You know, you've got an interesting background in that you have been one of the key people at the center of three scale-ups over the years. I'm sure there was probably a couple in between there that didn't work out quite so well. And now you're in a position where what you do is you advise other companies who are trying to make that transition from finding product market fit into scaling up to be an impressive company in their sector. And it'd be good to get your impressions about how cybersecurity companies can make that transition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take a transition over here to the business part of the discussion here, Roland. We're going to take your experiences at the three scale-ups you did, as well as everything you're working on right now with all your clients at the moment, and apply it to our favorite cybersecurity company, which is Cyber Donut. And listeners of the podcast are familiar with Cyber Donut. You know, the company's grown a little bit. It's up to 50 employees. We've got about 8 people in who are carrying a quota. We've got some SEs, some SDRs, and 3 people in marketing, as well as a leader in both sales and marketing. Customer-wise, we've got 5 design partners, let's say, and we've managed to get as many as about 20 real live paying customers as well. And we're just about to take our Series A. And we've done really well in the current climate of getting about $20 million for our Series A. And the excitement in the company is high. We're ready to go from experimenting and trying to figure out, do we have something to sell and how do we sell it, into actually ramping up the whole revenue engine. And I noticed that in your first book that you wrote, there's a quote in there that from you that says, a scale-up is a former startup looking to turn product market fit into product market dominance.
Wow, you've read my book, Andrew. I'm so impressed.
Of course. And everyone at Cyber Donut is thinking market dominance is what we're after. We're going to take on the world. We're excited. We've been through this whole world of hurt in the last 2-3 years trying to figure out product market fit. And now we're ready to take on the world. However, let me tell you a quick story. So a few years back, I was at a startup. And sales leader came in. They had a few design partners like Cyber Donut. I think we had about 15 customers or so. And it was a struggle. You know, the sales leader brought in a few people and we went out to the market and we're trying to sell what we have. And what we realized was that the product worked and people had the problem that we had, but there was no urgency around it. Right. We talk to people and they go, yeah, that's something that is not good for us. But, you know, they didn't really care that much. Right. There's few people that actually cared enough to say, let's go spin up a project and go solve this. And if they were, they were pretty low level people. Right. It was more senior you got in your prospect, the less they seemed to really care about what it was we were working on. And it kind of brought to mind the idea that sometimes there seems to be this thing where people think they're ready to scale, but perhaps are they really? And I'm wondering what your thoughts are as you're advising companies. Like, how do they know that they're ready to actually, you know, pour some fuel on this engine and get going?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question, and often actually the one I start with, are you ready to scale? Because one of the biggest dangers in the tech startup world is premature scaling, right? To stick with your analogy there, Andrew, basically it's starting to add a lot of fuel to an engine that's still sputtering, you know? That is one of the biggest risks, because all you do is starting to add expenses and complications, complexity to the business, where if you don't really have figured out what makes your customers tick and what makes them spend and spend more scale and return with you, then, you know, pouring more fuel on that inexistent fire is not going to help you. It's only going to hurt you.
So what drives them to do that though, Roland? Like, why would perfectly rational, intelligent, and smart human beings believe they're maybe a bit further ahead than they actually are?
Yeah, very good question. So delving into that a little bit, I think it's often a combination of sheer impatience combined with maybe a degree of fatigue and frustration that things are taking so long, with the incessant pitching to angels and VCs, where after a while you start turning the fake until you make it into something you truly believe, right? And so this is something that really is the most prevalent with people who are in that more investor relations function, go-to-market function, maybe, where they've learned so much to pitch beyond what they have already, which is actually a good practice, right? That they start to believe it too much. And that is, I think, where I typically say, yes, you need the Kool-Aid for sure. No startup would survive without Kool-Aid, but you also need a little bit of truth serum mixed into that, where you can hold each other accountable for what is actually happening, right?
Yeah, and in that situation, it was interesting. You know, the team that we put together, we all cycled out. The next team cycled out, and the next team after that cycled out. So it was like a third or fourth time around, I think they're at right now. How would you advise someone who believes they're seeing the real situation to actually work with the board or the CEO to say, well, actually, I don't think we're quite there yet?
It depends where they are at, right? Is it primarily because the board or the investors are saying, oh, you need to move faster and I need to see money coming in faster? Or is it because they truly believe that they're there? I think usually one of the levers that helps us the most is to get more tolerance for the team actually discussing where the company really is at. So an early stage company, in my experience, really cannot function unless they have a very forceful founder that just tells everyone what to do, because it's such a fiction at that stage that basically people need to just believe in that founder. And you'll find founders typically also hiring people who are primarily optimized for being zealots, believing the founder no matter what, right? And so I'm not against that. This is absolutely crucial in the beginning phase. But when you start scaling up, then it becomes important to also encourage multiple perspectives to be shared for people to find the truth together. And that's often where we start. Like, a very early exercise in working with companies is just drawing up what we think are our strengths, our weaknesses, our opportunities, and our threats, right? Or sometimes strengths, weaknesses, and just trends in the market. And all that does is get a common base about what do we believe and how do we prioritize what are the most important things that we have to work with. Understanding where our true strengths are, but also understanding where our weaknesses are that we may not change over time, as well as what are the big trends in the industry. And just creating that foundation of a common truth will actually make it much more likely that people will argue for the same priorities and the same strategies. Because it's my firm conviction, Andrew, that when people disagree, it's very often because they have a different framing or they have a different set of facts. And it's not because they're irrational in a way.
Now, imagine having a third party coming in to be the kind of devolved person, not involved in the day-to-day, right? Is a real benefit for them that can really drive the conversation.
Absolutely. This is very hard to do from inside the company. And believe me, I've tried. I mean, before I became an independent facilitator, I actually was an internal facilitator at Rocket Fuel and doing the scaling up program there. it is much, much harder to do that from the inside because, one, you're always swimming in your own soup, right? And two, it's very hard to challenge people that are more senior than you. The hierarchy always plays a part. And so I think one of the key benefits of getting an outsider to help you, whether it be a coach or a facilitator or whatever outside person, is that that new perspective. Also, from a different angle, I would say, very often you have this big worry in your head all the time as a founder, like, my God, I have no idea why my company is so messy. Everything else seems to work so much better. What is wrong with us, right? And an outsider will often, especially an outsider with experience, will often, ground you and let you know that, you know, every other company out there is equally messy on the inside. It's just that there you compare the nicely polished external marketing picture with your own internal reality, right? And so the grass truly is not necessarily greener on the other side.
Yeah, and having that the strength of character to power through that is what we look for from our founders, right? We want the person that can really drive the company forward like that through these kind of tough decisions and all the rest of it. I'm wondering, Rowan, as you think about, I'm sure every company is different, but as you think about the companies you work with, any patterns you see where as they're making the transition, these are the areas they tend to have to invest in or tend to have to make the biggest changes?
Absolutely. So, I work exclusively with tech companies. So typically software, sometimes there's hardware components. Comparing this to the Cyber Donut case, one thing that Cyber Donut has already done is invest properly in the whole go-to-market function. So quickly going through the company, as you described it, I counted about 20 people in the go-to-market side, maybe 19, if I have it correct, out of 50, right? Which is a little bit more than a third, which is really a standard I try to strive for around this time of them raising Series A. You wouldn't believe, Andrew, how many tech companies at that time are still 50, maybe even 100 engineers, and then there's two or three salespeople and half a marketing person, you know? And so you keep asking like, well, but, you know, if you want to grow, who is going to basically take care of that growth? And then many technical people in particular love this idea of product-led growth and like everything will just be the product itself. But really looking at that from a marketing perspective, that's just the better mousetrap fallacy in new clothes, right? Product-led growth has its place and it can really help spark a pipeline. But I think in general, it works much better for small business than for anything related to enterprise. And even then, it often is much more of a lead generation channel than an actual sales channel, especially for upselling and expansion.
Yeah, and I imagine that some people are looking at that headcount split and saying, I see burn rate, right? We're paying these people a lot of money to get our go-to-market figured out. Can we not cut it down a little bit? What if we had half? What if we had a few less? Must be a lot of pressure from technical founders to really question that.
Yeah, it's that. And there's also the worry about, but we have so many features we need to build. You know, we're not ready yet. Our product isn't good enough. So we need more engineers. And really, it is often more of a, call it a gap between what they think the product should be like in a almost good enough or even perfect way versus what the market actually requires. And those go-to-market people will also help you understand that very often the market is not there yet. They don't require all that much. 80% of what you're building, to be blunt, is probably not needed at this stage, right? And that's a very hard truth for technical people in particular to embrace. Even this morning, I was just in a workshop with a client in Singapore, and they were talking about this big issue on their roadmap. And I was just asking the marketing people in the room, is this the scope that you were looking for? And they kind of sheepishly said, actually, all we needed was a checkbox on the website. And so there's this tendency, Andrew, to kind of take a requirement and gold plate it and put it in the most perfect way possible. But this is really something that as a scale up, you have to be very good at, like, what is the minimum we can do to satisfy this requirement just a little bit? And then we can always decide to invest in it further once there's more demand for it. But will that demand lead to further upselling, to further expansion, to new customer segments coming on board? If not, why are we doing it?
I'm interested as the change happened the last few years, Rowan, from, you know, a lot of money flying around in the zero interest rate period, and now that's not the case. What changes have you seen about how people are planning their go-to-market growth and planning the engine growth over that time?
Yeah, very good question. And it's been very challenging, I have to be honest. Most companies and most founders were totally steeped in that mindset of like, let's just get growth at whatever cost. And at this point in time, capital is just too expensive for that, right? So now they have to learn to, put a lot less money in it up front. But still, investors, VCs want to see growth because that's ultimately what they invest in, right? So there's this much harder balance to strike between, you know, we want growth, but we don't want it to be too expensive. So can you grow a little bit slower? Is your competition also growing slower? Then very often it's too slow to actually make the VCs fund. So I think VCs also have trouble providing the right guidance there in terms of, you know, saying how much growth is actually good enough at this stage.
And in terms of allocating resources, then, if they're thinking growth, where do you see people getting the most bang for the buck right now? Is it more into sales headcount? Is it to marketing programs or marketing headcount? What are you seeing?
Yeah, good question. To be honest, I think many of the Series A level, Series B level companies in particular can get the best bang for the buck by focusing on their core business. And it's not necessarily the salespeople or it's marketing. It's very often that they're trying to run two, three businesses at the time. You know, they were seeking growth maybe in one segment that they had first, and then they were saying, okay, let's launch that other product, let's launch that other geography, let's launch that other segment. Before you know it, you have a combinatorial explosion of maybe like 120 different sandboxes, as I call them, right? Like all these combinations of segment, product, geography. And so it's in that complexity that a lot of money is lost. Where if you do a waterfall chart of how much of this is actually making us a gross profit, right, then very often out of those 120 sandboxes, there's less than five that actually do. All the rest is just basically a burden to the company. And so the key in my mind is to say, let's focus more on our very core. Let's remember where we started. What was the one segment and the one product and the one geography where we were most successful? And have we actually exhausted that? Right. So often you will ask that, what's that core? And they can tell you right away. And then I'm like, what's your market share in that initial core? And they say, oh, either we don't measure it or it's like less than 1% for sure. And then I'll say, so what are you doing trying to open up all these other sandboxes if you haven't even conquered your first sandbox yet? Right. Now, this is very radical. And of course, they will not shut down everything. But I will say the growth at any cost mindset has often led to lots of speculative arrays that are not paying off for the company. And that's the first area where I would cut.
So Cyberdonut should go back to their foundation, get clear on the vision and see if it has changed over time. Make sure it's not changed into eight different ways, but maybe one or two ways, and that they're working on the right things that really are going to make the big impact, right?
Yeah, if I were coaching Cyberdonut, that would be one of the first questions I would be asking. Are your 20 paying customers similar or are they very different? Like what areas are they in? Are they working for the same? Are they paying for the same product? Are they different kinds of segments? What verticals are they in? Questions like that to tease out all that complexity underneath.
You know, one thing I've experienced, Roland, back in the day when there was a lot of money flying around was, you know, planning the scale up was often a headcount exercise, right? If how many salespeople do we need to get the capacity to be able to, you know, drive this much growth? Things have changed, though. How are you encouraging companies to think about the planning side and how to actually plan for that scale in terms of systems or investments in people, et cetera?
Yeah, very good. So I would say there also first, we would look at, do you have one go-to-market motion or several go-to-market motions? And if you have several, which one is the most efficient, right? So many times people are doing all these experiments, like sometimes it's through events, sometimes it's online, sometimes it's in person, and they have and distributors and direct, and then maybe partners. And so, you know, like, are all these channels actually working? Is there not one bread and butter channel that works the best? I would actually invest more in that channel, but then cut down some of the other more experimental channels. And then I would say, like, look, let's start from the end and say, you know, what are your sales targets? Do you have the capacity to actually reach those sales targets with the people you have starting from sales? So assuming here that it's a direct sales model, right? You need certain sellers to close all this business, but then you calculate back, like, what's the pipeline for that, right? So how many SDRs do you need to book all these meetings? How many marketing campaigns do you need to reach those? I think, again, the complexity comes from actually telling people, for example, in marketing, like your main job is actually to generate those leads. It's not at this point in time to reinvent the brand or to come up with all these like employee marketing materials or all the stuff that may matter in the long run, but doesn't matter in the short run so much. So it's really a focusing exercise and helping people to understand like your main contribution to the company is just this pipeline and then the sales that results from that. Same for customer success. Of course, it wasn't mentioned here that much, but in SaaS in particular, the initial landing in enterprise is often very tiny, but then upselling, keeping people happy, getting expanded, getting more seats, that is probably the biggest revenue driver. And one scary number I read just yesterday, Andrew, is that net revenue retention in SaaS is now down to 63% only.
63? Wow.
63%, yeah. So, you know, that is actually really undermining this whole model of steady growth out of SaaS, which where we, I think we used to say 100% is not good, 120% starts being good, 140% is great, right? Net revenue retention, where we're far below that now.
Yeah, no kidding. It's interesting. I was talking to Tim Eads, who's a general partner of the Cyber Mentor Fund. This was last year. And his take was he would actually hire a CS person probably in the first two or three people on the go-to-market side, because getting someone happy is going to be a bigger driver for your success than trying to generate just more leads, for example. So he wanted someone, even if you only three or five customers, he wanted someone to be responsible for making them extremely happy, so that they go out there and talk about it in the marketplace.
Yeah, and that's actually a story I also hear on the marketing side, where the most experienced marketers say, you know, the first marketer I hire is actually a product marketer, just to make sure we get our messaging right and that we make sure that people talk about the right things. And only then do I start getting a lead gen marketer to basically start scaling up that lead generation.
Yeah, yeah. Do the marketing folks tend to gravitate to being okay with lead gen as their primary job, or
no,
do they feel like they're being snipped a little bit?
I know very few marketers who are excited about lead generation. And, you know, it's because I always give this example when I coach a team, like when we set up the KPIs, we always ask like, okay, what's the one number without which your function wouldn't exist? And even then, when I ask specifically for one number, they all come up with like four or five different KPIs, right? And then we have to be very annoying with each of the functions and tell engineering, like, look, you may care a lot about stability and new technologies, but in the end, what matters the most is you delivering new features, right? And same for marketing. What matters the most is leads. And then they all go like, yes, I know.
Well, for sales, it's very clear, right? The KPIs are usually pretty obvious.
Yes, exactly. But even in sales, sometimes it is so much easier to just stick with current clients and, you know, get more out of them. Whereas the main challenge of the company for the longer run is to get more logos, right? And so we all have jobs in which we are asked to do certain things that make us uncomfortable. But it's important to understand what the company actually needs from us rather than what we'd like to do best, right?
You know, I've seen two approaches to this, Roland. I've seen people, like take Cyber Donut right now. Let's say they're going to hire, I don't know, 10 or 15 more people on the sales side because they've got this $20 million burning the hole in their pocket. And I've seen people go two paths. One is, well, let's get coverage. Let's hire heads and get coverage. And I've seen people go for, well, I want quality and I don't mind paying for quality. I really want the athlete there that's going to make a difference. What's your thought about that?
I think it depends a lot on how much infrastructure you have already. And by infrastructure, I mean particularly a playbook. Like, do you have the guidelines of how to sell this product? And very often that's sorely missing. Even companies that have scaled to this level where everyone is still figuring out how do we actually sell this, I think that would be a sign of premature scaling, right? So it's not just about having the product in place, but also having figured out like what's the messaging roughly, what's the sales process roughly, or the tactics roughly that get people to actually sign up. And in the beginning, that's just the founder who can do it. I don't think you can hire a salesperson too early to figure that out for you, right? But once that playbook is in place, then I think it's actually much better to just get more relative junior people in there so that you can cover more territory. And then really focus on training the managers and the leaders to do a good job at gardening, at weeding out their garden of people, I would say.
Okay. So it's going to be scale through coverage. And then you want those people to be, you know, sponges so that they can figure out, they can learn from the playbook, essentially, right?
Learn from the playbook, but also, you know, have enough people so that there's a healthy competition and that people are not getting complacent, right? I mean, we all know that many salespeople are driven by a little friendly competition. So why not use that to our advantage?
Roland, let's learn a little bit more about you. I'm going to spin the wheel here and let that choose questions for us to ask you. So let me start here and see what number it comes up with. All right, number 32. How did you make money as a kid?
How did I make money as a kid? Well, to be honest, that was not my primary concern, as I hope it wasn't for most kids. But when I did make money as a kid, it was usually just by doing odd little errands or jobs for the older people in my family, like my grandma, like an old uncle and stuff like that. And it was also at that time already clear to me that the value of money they had in mind was very different, because sometimes for the same job, I would get five times as much as from another, maybe more stingy uncle.
Yeah, I remember those days. You sometimes get something from one person, you're like, wow, that's amazing. And then you get three times as much for another. And for them, it's all nothing. But for you, it's like, wow, gosh, I've got this much.
It was just an early learning, because that's exactly how enterprise sales works later on in life too, right?
That's right. And I should say, by the way, my spinning the wheel here, I'm using a very sophisticated AI next generation wheel spinning device here. It's being audited by Deloitte to make sure that the questions that it picks are completely random.
Well, the AI part sounded really modern. The audited by Deloitte may be a little bit less so, but anyway, Andrew.
Well, let's hope they're reasonably modern. Let's see. Let's spin it again and see what question it comes back with. Number 9, what is one of your most memorable moments in business?
Yeah, so here I would say this is to do with your positioning in the market. In my earliest scale-up, Telenet, we were kind of bogged down in our product pipeline, as happens in so many tech companies, and nothing was coming out. And we really were losing deals because we were not following the market closely enough, and customers started to get a feel for these guys are just too slow. So we launched what I call the One Innovation Per Month program, where I just told a team of really junior people, like, look, one engineer, one marketer, one customer support person, you together, you come up with an innovation once per month. I don't care what it is, as long as we can announce it to the customer. And it can be as tiny as you want it to be, but we want to announce something, right? And that worked in extraordinarily well, because basically just by empowering people and letting them run a pipeline of ideas, where very often at the very last minute, they would swap out one that wasn't ready yet for something they had on the back burner. You know, it actually led us to 15 innovations in 1 year, so more than once a month. And we won a prize for the most innovative company in our industry at the end of that year. And of course, sales turned around accordingly.
They must have loved having that level of responsibility and freedom to do, you know, cool things.
They did, after an initial period of fear, which I've really learned at that time, often comes with empowerment as well, because, you know, it's easy to complain about your boss taking all the wrong decisions. But then once you're actually responsible, it starts to feel very differently. So there's definitely a period of hand-holding needed in the beginning. But yes, absolutely, they loved it. And I think it still set them up for life, because they've all grown to be powerful executives in their own right now.
Oh, I love that. That's awesome. All right, let's spin the wheel again and get our last question here. All right, number 19. What is the story behind getting your job at Telenet?
Yeah, so I think looking back, it was really because I was a pioneer at the new technologies of the time. And maybe that's even a red thread that I can pull back through some of my other scale-ups as well. But to stick with Telenet, I had been one of the first people in Belgium, the country where I lived at the time, to be involved in the internet from a non-technical perspective. So I was a research assistant at universities, my first job after graduating, and was exploring all the social ethical and political consequences of this newfangled technology, which led to media coverage, which led to me founding the very first website company in Belgium. And so when Telenet, a kind of cable provider, wanted to start launching broadband internet and wanted somebody in marketing product management for that, they said, okay, this is really the only guy who has some relevant experience that we can recruit right now.
Now, Belgium is not a large country, let's say, right? Were you in a very small group of people that could have even been working in that whole area?
Well, it was very small. And, you know, it's not a large country, as you say. It's only 10 million people, or it was at the time. Plus, this was a rollout of a cable network towards making it available for broadband internet. So all of these networks had to be physically converted, which really meant that in the beginning, there were only two communities that had even had the technology available. So that was really another learning there. Like, how do you do a market test in a tiny area? Where it was even forbidden from doing like the things that would be most efficient in those areas, such as like knocking on doors and getting to know people, right? Because they said no, because we need to test how to make marketing that will actually work nationally. And we have to say, ultimately, this became part of a much broader European-wide group. So the scope was never limited to just Belgium. The learnings were going to be applied in a much broader context than just this small country.
Two last questions for you. Let's imagine the Cyber Donut team, the sales leader that's there right now was there right from the start. Sometimes a temptation to say, well, we need horses for courses. We need to bring in someone who's skilled from 1 to 5 or 5 to 10 or whatever it might be. How do you know whether you've got someone who's going to be scalable with that model and someone who won't be?
I think it's a very good question. I think generally people assume that people will just be okay until they are not. And I would often encourage people to reverse that thinking and say, assume that if they're good at this phase, they're not going to be good at that phase. One key insight I got from some research done in London, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, they went through all of the companies that raised Series A and then looked 5 years later, like how many had become a unicorn. And they tried to correlate that to personnel decisions, like did they hire people from a great school? Did they hire people with experience or not experience? And the most insightful part there was that none of these factors seemed to matter that much. There was no clear correlation between all those things that they would have expected. There was only one factor that truly did make a difference, and that was how quickly they replaced people in their executive team. And this is a bit shocking. It was to me when I heard it, but they said that the best companies that made it to unicorn status on average changed one thing in their executive team every quarter.
One person, typically.
And this was not necessarily firing someone. It could also have been combining some responsibilities. It could be promoting someone. It could be, you know, the person stays at the company, but we hire someone above them. So all kinds of changes, right? But basically, they said one time a quarter is ideal because it's just enough change to keep people on their toes. But at the same time, since they, you know, for an average team of 12 people, that would mean my job typically on average lasts 3 years, right? So that's still enough safety, psychological safety, to still do a good job and invest a little bit in the future. And the other thing they said is that average of 3 years is probably also related to people just burning out over that time. Because, you know, after 3 years in such an intense environment as a scale-up, you may still be able to work, but are you able to still give your best? Probably not.
It does seem very Machiavellian, though, that it's just the fact of having to replace people like that.
It is absolutely true. And the good news is that almost all companies actually keep these people and keep them for a long time, even long post IPO. It's just that at some point in time, they say, maybe you shouldn't be on the executive team anymore, right? And as I said, very often, those people are actually by that time, yeah, they'll need some convincing, but afterwards, they're often actually relieved that they are no longer carry that big responsibility and that some fresh blood can actually do that for them.
Yeah. And maybe this last question is kind of related to this, but one of the things I've seen is people bringing in a sales leader, and then either the CEO and the CFO or even the board just tell them what the number is and they have to go do it. And they don't involve them in the planning and the deciding and, you know, figuring out what the right model and rate is. How do you encourage a sales leader who's been treated like that to maybe try and get more of a seat at the table and maybe get more collaboration with the board?
Yeah, I think, first of all, this is not a problem that's only related to sales. I think engineering leaders will say the same, product leaders will say the same, HR recruiting leaders will say the same. And so I think it's really more about instituting a discipline of doing both top-down and bottom-up planning, right? And so we often use what we call the W model, which in a nutshell really means with, yes, you should absolutely start with expectations from the board or from the CEO, but then have the teams come back with what's our bottom-up planning. Then you have a session where you reconcile it, and then you still have another like down and up where you go to even deeper levels of teams and have them write up what they're actually going to execute, right? So this sounds a little bit complicated, but it really helps to reconcile those top-down and bottom-up views and get people to see why they think differently. For bottom-up planning, of course, you need to see why a board thinks this is not only feasible, but also a target that we should make in order to be successful. For people in the board and the CEO, it also matters that they see why people think something is not feasible and why it's not realistic to be expecting this. What I see too often, Andrew, is that people just shove all these discussions under the carpet, and then it's at the end of the quarter that they figure out this was never feasible. So can we please move that a few months ahead?
I like that approach, right? Take it as a starting point, and maybe it's the right number, maybe it's not, but at least go through the bottoms up and top down to figure that out. And don't sit there after 6 months going, yeah, but it wasn't the right number in the first place.
Exactly. Plus, you know, by having this as a process, it also actually allows the CEO and maybe even the board to then be more free and say, you know, I think I want to set this target because this is what I think the market will require. Now let other people come back with all the objections of why that's not feasible. It's not up to the CEO to say upfront, like, let me take into account what I think is feasible or not feasible. That's for the team to say.
Yeah. Well, final thought, you know, CyberDonut is getting the 20 million. They've got their plans in place. Any final kind of rallying call for the leadership team to go and take on and become the dominant player in the market?
Get your rhythms in place. And the rhythms, by that I mean, you have to have the discipline of actually executing on your targets. And that means you want to have on a weekly basis a look at your targets and fix anything that's off track. On a quarterly basis, you want to revise your targets, set new goals or OKRs, whatever the system is that you prefer. On an annual basis, you want to revise your strategy. And these should be targets that should be rhythms that are set well in advance. It's always the same time every week, every quarter, every year. Agenda should be almost like set in advance so that people know this is the base that we can count on, the foundation that will make this company successful.
That's great, Roland. If someone wants to get hold of you and tap into your experience and take you on as an advisor, what's the best way for them to get hold of you?
Yeah, so the best way is to go to midstage.org/thrive, which is our summary page of everything we do, some key podcasts, videos, and as well as all the contact links. Please connect with me on LinkedIn, Bridged, and then we will be in touch.
Awesome. Good to chat.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Really been an honor.
It would mean a lot to me and to the continued growth of the show if you'd help get the word out. So how do you do that easily? There are two ways. Firstly, just simply send a link to a friend. Send a link to the show, to this episode. You can email it, text it, Slack it, whatever works for you and is easy for you. The second way is to leave a super quick rating. And sometimes that can seem complicated, so I've made it as easy for you as I can. You simply have to go to ratethispodcast.com/cyber. That's ratethispodcast.com/cyber, and explains exactly how to do it. Either of these ways will take you less than 30 seconds to do, and it will mean the world to me. So thank you.